You're listening to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. My guest for this episode is Peter Bain, author of the Permaculture Handbook, Garden Farming for Town and Country. I've been interested in interviewing Peter for some time, but only after writing a review of his book and some encouragement when speaking with a potential guest did I finally work up the nerve to reach out to him to have him on the show. I was kind of scared for a couple of reasons. First, I'd written a review of his book, and though generally positive, it's a little strange to talk to someone who you've written about but never met. He's also the publisher of The Permaculture Activist and fairly well known in this community. Lastly, he's also in the line of my permaculture education. Thinking of my two permaculture design course teachers as my dads of permaculture, Dylan Naber, who you heard from in the first episode of the relaunch of the show in 2012, and Ben, who you haven't heard from yet but I hope to speak with soon. And Peter was one of Ben's instructors, kind of making Peter the grandfather of my permaculture knowledge. And I didn't know if he was going to be a kind and friendly grandfather, or whether he was going to be stern and severe. Thankfully, as you'll hear in this interview, he was definitely the former. Very easy to speak to. We had a nice long conversation, which resulted in a longer episode. We spoke for about 2 hours. Of which about an hour and 20 minutes made it into the show. We talk about the Permaculture Handbook, but as always begin with his bio, and wind through why he wrote the book, who his intended audience for the book is, and then wrap up with some listener questions, one of which is about how large Zone 5 or the wilderness should be, and a rather long question which I'll encapsulate as a discussion of the third ethic of permaculture. For those of you who are outside the United States, portions of this conversation revolve around United States history, culture, mythology, politics, which can be specific to time and place. So please give it a listen. This conversation provides a wonderful context for why we encounter some of the difficulties that we do here with implementing and growing permaculture. After you finish the interview, stay with me for a little bit, as I have some notes and additional information on Peter's upcoming book tour, and I'll catch up with you after the conversation.
Then, as I always like to do, I ask my guests for a little bit of their background and how they came to permaculture, and then we can move into the interview proper.
Okay. Well, I'm a Midwesterner by birth. I grew up in central Illinois and was educated there at the University of Illinois. And then began traveling, something that had done a lot for me in my youth or my teenage and school years to broaden my horizons. I was fortunate enough to travel to Europe in the late 60s and then again in the early 70s. And to take advantage of what I didn't realize at the time was an enormous privilege that Americans had from our wealth and power, to see the world and to see many of the cultural treasures that had undergirded American civilization and that had been invisible to me growing up in a fairly anodyne or vanilla part of the country. After school, I did many things, and most of them were sort of trying to avoid being eaten by the empire, I would say now. I didn't pursue a career. I didn't know what my career needed to be. I knew that I had big questions about the world, about where it was going, about what was wrong. As it turns out, now the statistics sort of show what my dilemma was. I graduated from college in 1973, and we now know from the economic history that that was the beginning of the very long, slow decline in American fortunes that followed on the peaking of American oil production in 1970. We went into a decade more or less of stagnation and recession and alienation, and then we got Ronald Reagan, who started, you know, dismantling the architecture of American wealth and transferring it over to the elites. And all this time, I'm like, what is going on? This doesn't make sense to me. And so I lived in different parts of the country, in different parts of the world, and I did a lot of common jobs. I worked in food service for a decade or so. I ran a bakery, and I worked in bakeries and restaurants, and if you're in that trade, you can go pretty much anywhere and find a job. Certainly in that era, it wasn't hard. I didn't make much money. I had all kinds of experiences, and along the way, the things that appealed to me came somewhat accidentally, but I early on encountered the writings of Ivan Illich through a friend and realized Illich had something very powerful to say to me and to others in the modern world. As he wrote from the perspective of a medieval historian, he was looking at the whole project of the modern world that got going in the European period of the formation of nation states, you know, from Henry VIII in England onward, you know, about 1500, that created and laid the foundation for these institutions that dominate our lives today, that have shaped the world that we live in. That seemed to be ripe for failure, let us say, already beginning to break down. That's how it seemed to me as a young man. It still seems that way to me. And we are playing out something of that endgame, perhaps, in my lifetime. I encountered many other things, you know, and I, for some reason that was probably innate, I got drawn into food and began exploring organic food and the notion of whole food and local foods and all the things that were being explored and discussed in the late 70s and through the 80s and so on. It didn't become any kind of religion for me, but it was something that seemed worthwhile in a world that was crazy, and so I stuck with it. It seemed harmless, morally, you know, harmless to work at making food and serving food to people. So I did that to make a living. One reason or another, it got me out to the Hawaiian Islands, partly because my critique of American politics and economics in the 80s was such that I couldn't stomach it. I saw in the election of Ronald Reagan a kind of willful diving off the cliff or turning toward insanity of the nation. A lot of people, you know, reacted against Jimmy Carter's common sense message that we needed to turn down the thermostat and deal with our energy excesses. They instead turned to this bizarre character out of the California film scene, very dubious political background, and very dubious political associates. And so we got the beginning of this whole right-wing pushback against the era of the 70s and even more. But I left the country. I went to Ireland, I went to Mexico, I finally wound up in Hawaii, which is a place where I could work because I was a citizen, and spent some time working there, and eventually stumbled across permaculture. You're wondering where all this was going, I'm sure. Your listeners, anyway, will be. I found it accidentally. Again, somebody was leafleting. I found a leaflet. I called the man up. I bought Bill Mollison's Permaculture Design Manual, which had then recently been published. And I learned that there would be a course the following year on the islands. So the first in about a decade since Mollison first came there in 1980, began teaching in the United States on the island of Molokai. Then there was a long gap. None of his students really stepped into teaching, so the islands hadn't had any further development in permaculture. But another pair of Australians were coming through, and I took a course, and it changed my life. It started me on a new career. I got a whole new set of friends. I took up the business that I still run. I actually got married at that point and began a family. So many things shifted, and permaculture moved front and center. And it began, as I'm sure many of your interviewees will have said in one way or another, to organize the disparate parts of my mind and my aspirations and the world around me into something coherent and actionable, to borrow current usage.
It seems to be a common thread, as you mentioned, among people who take a permaculture design course and find this path, that there's this introduction, and for those of us who stick with it, even if we have to allow it to ferment and grow inside of ourselves for a while, there comes a point where we connect with it and it becomes this driving force, whether it's after a long delay, a short delay, or something that just carries on for, as when I spoke with Chuck Marsh, for 30 years, or you now, for 25 or so, would be fair to say?
It's 22 years. It'll be 23 years January. Right in the period, yeah. It's about 23 years now. Nearly a quarter century. Long enough to know better, I guess. The point you make is one that I think the Zen teachers frame as when the student is ready, the teacher appears. It's interesting that I actually encountered permaculture in 1982, about 7 years before it bit me. It came through the door of a shop I was working in, and someone laid it out for me, you know, Mollison and Holmgren's two original books, Permaculture 1 and 2. I looked at them. I saw the diagrams. I looked at the small print. I thought, curious. And that was it. It was like in one eye and out the other. And I didn't have another thought about it. And then when I found it, I found a clue to it. I was ready, and I took it up. Not quite that moment. I actually carried the leaflet around for several months and then said, okay, I think this is the time, and called the fellow. And it was like going down the rabbit hole in a certain way. Just like everything shifted. It was all the tumblers lined up, the lock opened, the door swung through, and, you know, trumpets blazed and whatever else dramatic you might want to imagine. It was pretty strong for me. The experience of taking the PDC, the Permaculture Design Course, was powerful. It was what I've since learned to call a metanoia, a change of worldview. It was a shift of paradigm. It completely reorganized my patterns of thinking. And it was ecstatic, really. I was in a kind of state of extended bliss for 2 weeks with 28 or 30 other people. Oblivious in a certain way to what was around us. I mean, it was crazy. It was raining cats and dogs. We were on the south end of the island of Hawaii, and there was dozens of inches of rain were falling those 2 weeks. We barely saw the sun. It didn't seem to matter. Floods were going on around us. It was biblical in that sense. It could have been Noah and the Ark, but there we were somehow with a blackboard in the Zendo sitting, you know, or Tibetan, actually it was a Tibetan monastery, in the room above the kitchen, learning about ecosystems design and reformulating the world together.
This is kind of an aside question. As you walked through your process of finding this class and ruminating on it before making the phone call and having 7 years between the first introduction and when you took the course, I guess I would say I'm a generation after you. I was born at the tail end of the Carter administration. The Reagan administration is something that I don't really remember.
Yeah.
If you will, Bill Clinton is like the first president that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As I watched the transformation of war into a video game, that one shot over and over again of dropping that bomb down like a chimney over and over again during the first Iraq conflict. But one of the things that I encounter often in talking with people about culture and sociology is that there are no longer like rites of initiation or rites of passage for people. And I wonder if that intense, cohesive experience of a permaculture design course for many people, because they actively pursue it and pay that money out of pocket to take the course, that one of the reasons it has such a resounding and profound effect on them is because it's almost a type of rite of passage in the modern era for people that they don't find elsewhere.
That's a very interesting speculation. I'm certainly aware of the problem that that lack represents in our culture. I've felt it in my own life, but I've not linked it up in the way that you've just suggested. It could be playing a role. In fact, many people are going around longing for that recognition. One of the things that Mollison sets forth strongly in his writings and his speaking is the importance of taking responsibility for the life around us, our own and that of our descendants, as he puts it in the Prime Directive. And that's, if you will, the underlying moral message, ethical message of all rites of passage from childhood to adulthood. All young people are enjoined by their societies to put second their personal needs to the group life. And we don't get that. In fact, the explicit injunctions of our cultural message machine are take care of yourself, take care of yourself, take care of yourself, look out for number one. And this has bearing on our opening remarks about the question we'll deal with later in the interview and how Americans have come to view the notion of sharing. But for me, it was a welcome message because my own family background is certainly much more oriented. And I grew up among people of an earlier generation for whom real practical survival meant care of the group, of the larger group. You looked out for your family, not just your immediate family, but your extended family and the neighborhood you lived in and the people you came from and all of that tribal sensibility. So I had a more expanded, if you will, ethical views to begin with. And when permaculture took it to the level of saying, care for the whole of the earth and all the species and all the ecosystems, I was ready for that. I had been through the aha moments of the 70s that had seen the planet hanging in space and had realized the limitations of the earth. And we still have, all of us, a long way to go to make those aspirations real. But at least I think people who come to permaculture are somehow awakened to the need for it.
And now all those years since those first days when you came to permaculture, it's been much waited for by many of us in the community, that you've taken your time and experience and put that together in a nice, beautiful, portable form in your permaculture handbook. And that's what I'd like to talk with you about next, is that journey to putting all of that together and the material that you present for others that will now speak forward for you through time.
Well, I don't know that it would have come to pass if I hadn't sort of been nudged into it again. And maybe that's a life pattern, that things happen to me accidentally that need to happen. But I was approached by my publisher and asked to write a book on permaculture. And in hindsight, it looks, I suppose you could say, inevitable, or of course, as you say, people have been anticipating it or looking for it. I'm not sure how personal that is. There's some sense of a moment that this book was needed. And I suppose it's from that sensibility that I wrote it. And also the feeling that, well, yes, I have no excuse not to, since I've been asked. I do know something, and I should try to put it down. There was a summation of what I've learned, certainly. And I hope learned more than simply facts, but maybe some understanding about what this message that I've received means for people in their lives and how they need to use it. Because that seems to me a greater value. Although the facts themselves are fairly grounded in the physical reality of nature and aren't likely to change a lot, even beyond, well beyond my lifetime. But I think for the importance of this book, maybe in its value to speak to people, to invite them to do this thing that permaculture is asking of all of us, just get engaged and make the world a healthier place, one in which people can live in communion with nature.
And I found that your book, the first section on attitudes, gives a lot of that timeless inspiration to really get people to take this to heart and put it into action in a way that isn't scary or intimidating. Which, if you pick up some of the other material, if you read Holmgren's Principles and Pathways, or pick up Mollison's Designer's Manual, they can be very heavy. One of my teachers said that it took him several years to make it through Holmgren's Principles and Pathways just because of how theory heavy it was, and the thought patterns and constructs that you have to work your way through to get at the core of that message, whereas what you've provided is very accessible. And I don't want to say easy to take in, because I feel that in some ways is dismissive of your experiences and what you've put there, but it's just accessible in ways that I haven't encountered previously.
Well, thank you for that. I made a very deliberate attempt to write it in the vernacular, the American vernacular. People have pointed out that this doesn't so much dismiss people of other cultures and places, but it simply looks past them in directing most of its message to North Americans, the English speaking, primarily English and French speaking, and now Spanish speaking societies of North America, who do so much to impact the planet. It's been my rather difficult charge, I think, in the last 20 years of my permaculture career, to somehow apply what I've learned, and which Chuck Marsh was saying in your earlier interview with him, people overseas find so easily accessible, so ready to put to use. They need it more. Americans are not yet aware that they need it, but the world needs Americans to get it. So crafting the right message has first been a matter of learning, but then of translating permaculture's odd Australianisms and the personalities and flavors of Holmgren and Mollison and other authors into an American language, one that people will find perhaps not comforting. The message is still strong, but accessible and not different from them. So that was the first piece. And then there's not just the language, but also the cultural context, which limits the book in a certain way. I mean, I'm trying to write to where I think the center of that mass of people is in this part of the world. And they are homeowners. They are a little bit above desperate economically. They have some means still, therefore, to direct their destinies. And they live with a little bit of landscape. Yes, many of them are urban dwellers on small plots, but many more of them are probably living on the edge of the city or in urbanized areas where they have suburban plots of a quarter acre or more. Some of them may be people who've gone a little beyond the city and have bought slightly little farmettes or have ambitions to do the same thing. Those people can transform the landscape. And so I'm deliberately choosing to write to that audience that has a potential for action, for effective action, rather than the desperately poor or those people who don't need to do anything at all, the ones who are under increasing pressure but still have the possibility to act. That's where the leverage point is, I believe, today.
This book is really then kind of oriented towards that large middle-class American populace then.
Yes, and as some people have recently been trying to point out, there are blind spots in that middle class. It thinks that it can fix the world, and it doesn't know how much privilege it has, and it doesn't sort of understand its role in the middle. I'm trying to share what I've learned as corrective to those defects and broaden the perspective while making people aware who are middle class, middle income, middle of the country, what have you, middle of the society, how important it is that they reach out across generations, across fences, to help glue the whole society together, because we're in a storm. You know, the wind is rising and we're headed into it. It's going to get harder. And famously, Yeats said, the center will not hold, or it doesn't hold. There's some of that going on right now anyway. And so those of us who find the center important are going to have to do more work, exert some of ourselves to strengthen that muscle that might begin to hold the society together through the turbulence that's upon us.
That middle that you're directing towards, is that one of the reasons why you included the tables and the discussion of like dollars and cents, and that if someone were to take this model and transition away, that they could potentially earn a comfortable middle-class income on an acre or two in a peri-urban region, to show that it's possible in a way that speaks directly to things that people can relate to, that they can look at their paycheck and go, oh, well, I'm making X number of dollars and this model provides me the potential of earning Y. That's doable?
I don't think that the finding is original to me. I've cited other people who've done the experiments more rigorously. There's a fairly large body of people who've turned away from conventional middle-class careers toward farming, small-scale farming, because they wanted to work outdoors, they wanted to work with their hands, they wanted to be creative problem solvers, they wanted to be self-employed. You know, often these were people at a stage where they were empty nesters or had a turn in their career path or in some other way had the freedom to make that choice. But still, in their doing it, they made a deliberate turn away from pursuing higher levels of income and conventional privilege in favor of quality of life. So that's what I'm highlighting with the book, because I think, well, you know, some people will be wise, and I'm prejudiced in this way, will be wise in choosing that path while they still can, and others will be abruptly bumped into it and might like the consolation that comes with recognizing, oh, well, I could make an acceptable living and do what I like now that I'm unemployed, now that I don't have my, you know, job with AT&T or Bank of America or whatever, because I've been laid off. And this will continue because the conventional economy is contracting, and it doesn't have any other choice. It's got to contract along with energy supplies. It's been in a contraction, and we've had that hidden from us by political and economic maneuvering over your lifetime and more. So now this is the choice people are faced with. We go on in this game of musical chairs, where the masters of the universe keep throwing a chair out the window every now and then, and some of us have to fall to the floor and get trod upon. Or some of us walk out of the room or jump out the window. It's on the first floor, by the way. It's not that harsh to do now. And I'm encouraging as many people as possible to make the steps back away from this hypnotic trance dance that's going on that keeps drawing our life energy into it, and get out, start putting our marbles outside, our eggs in another basket, so that when the walls of that place fall down, we won't be inside it.
Provide a model that people who are already engaged can start taking those steps now before there is a need, but at the same time provide a way that people who come to have that need can realize that it's not that far of a jump and it's a very soft landing once they make the step.
Well, I hope so. I don't want to delude anyone into thinking this is easy, in the sense that, oh, it's just another career path and, you know, you take a different ticket and you go through a different turnstile. Yes, there's that, but then you find, well, yeah, you work. So, you know, like a 64-year-old friend to me said today, you know, reminded of the Beatles song, "Will You Still Love Me When I'm 64? Yeah. She said, I'll be 65 next year and I'm just starting to farm. I must be crazy. But there are an awful lot of people who are going to be saying things like that. And I'm only a little bit younger than that age, and I'm kind of in that state. Well, I've been farming for a dozen years now, and so I got into it when I wasn't quite so creaky. But, you know, it's like, okay, is this doable? Well, yes. You know, you look around, you see a lot of farmers are old, and a lot of farmers get very old, and so maybe it's not such a bad life. In any case, I think that it may look like a choice now, and for many of us, it may not be a choice in 10 or 20 years, or at some point in the future, in a certain time. Why not begin now? In another perspective, and I could say this, you know, not cynically, but just sort of realistically, it's very late in the game. We're 40 years down the line from the limits to growth, from the warning signals, from the shot across the bow. You know, like, what you been doing? Not you. You weren't born 40 years ago, but a lot of people who could have done a different path didn't find a way. So much of what the opening of the book is, you talked about the first part, the attitudes, is telling that story and weaving people into it. Because everybody who takes that different ticket and goes through that other turnstile right now is joining a small but growing parade of people who started making different choices 40 years and even longer ago. 50, 80 years ago, it was individuals 40 years ago, it was small groups, and it came to be communities, and more, it's whole tribes and families and neighborhoods of people. And that's what I'm hoping to reach now, is that swelling tide.
And I'd like to talk about what you're doing to spread this message and the outreach you're doing, because I saw that you'll be in Philadelphia here in a few weeks. But before we get there, one of the other parts of your books that really intrigued me was your development of a garden farm pattern language. And I was wondering if you could kind of guide us through that process of how you came to that and putting that together.
Well, I was captivated by the writings of Christopher Alexander and his colleagues from very early on and long before I knew anything about permaculture. And that had worked on me. I understood that it was a different way of knowing. The Greek word is epistemology. It was a different way of knowing the world that rooted knowledge in the body and not merely in the mind. So it was, if you will, anti-Cartesian, in so much as Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, and set Western culture in a certain mold that our educational system has reified, has supported, has reproduced. Alexander was saying, I feel, therefore I am. I feel, and from this feeling, I create the world. That's what he and his colleagues discovered. It's not an invention on their part. It's a discovery, for they deliberately looked at traditional ways of existing in the world, classically beautiful and appealing urban and other environments, and began to ask the questions, how were these made? That's what the pattern language series of books, it begins with the timeless way of building and continues with the pattern language and the Oregon experiment and the Linz Cafe and the production of houses and a new theory of urban design. Those six volumes represent a sort of corpus of work that is attempting to change, reframe the entire process of building civilization worldwide, but starting from the sort of the center of Western civilization, saying that what we did in the modern world was a bad turn, a detour we need to back out of and repudiate and get back on the main track that had existed in the era more or less running up to the discovery and wide application of fossil fuels. So in that way, Alexander's architecture, and that I use his name to stand for all the many multi-ethnic authors who collaborated with him, Sara Ishikawa and all the others, because it's easy to retain. They offered a way of building, and one that was putting out a popular method of design, a way that re-empowered people to create living environments around them. And that was entirely compatible with all of the critique of permaculture, which is an energy analysis of where the world's been and where it's going and what we have to do as a result of that. So I got it. So I had that piece. When I met permaculture, it was like, well, duh. This. And then I discovered, well, my permaculture teacher was talking about it too, and others had put this together. It seemed a no-brainer. And so I've carried Alexander and his works and the whole notion of body-centered architecture and ways of building and vernacular design, popular design, with me all the way along and woven it into all of my teaching. So it was not any difficult step to conceive of a pattern language for the garden farming book, the permaculture handbook. In fact, I'd been invited in a way to do that by my colleague, Dave Jackie, who wrote a small language, pattern language for forest gardening in his Edible Forest Gardens work, which he wrote with Eric Tainsmeyer in 2005. So there he deliberately links it to Alexander's work. He gives 57 patterns or something like that, one of which is directly borrowed from Alexander, Site Repair, and talks about how this applies to the architecture of plant relationships. Well, that's cool. You know, that's really amazing and wonderful, and they're poetic. It's a beautifully written language, and I was much enamored of it. And it has very specific applications in the plant world. It's not, maybe there are analogies for the human world, but I would say it left open then vast fields for this way of thinking to be brought through into the permaculture community. And so it was, well, I know how to do this. I've read and appreciated Alexander in all of his books, and I think I get it, and I think I have the ability to craft words. And now I've done this. I began this work to write that chapter at least 10 years ago when I began deliberately teaching my students, of whom Ben Leif, your teacher, was one, about the pattern language method, which combines understanding from the two halves of the brain, the shape perceiving right hemisphere of the brain and the symbolizing language capacity of the left. And there's always a dialogue between the two when good work or even good life is happening. We need to both recognize things intuitively and before words and in their shapes and in our relation to them, and then we begin to tell stories about it, about those things, about the world around us, and we weave them back and forth together. So that is the process of design, and I've begun laying that out to my students as how they should look at the world. They should trust their feelings. They should put those feelings foremost. They should become more in touch with their intuitions. They should begin to recognize first impressions are often profoundly true, and how to test those, how to analyze them, how to shape them, how to give them voice, and that was itself a new and not yet tapped design method or modality that needed to be in permaculture, needed to be better developed in permaculture. So I've been using my students as guinea pigs. I've been making them go through this process stumblingly, haltingly, awkwardly, and over with each repeat, with each iteration, I've seen better results. I get better at explaining the concepts, laying them out, stepping back. People seem to be creating, you know, a creode, a path in the noosphere, in the world of ideas. So this meme comes through clearer and faster and more powerful. And what was at first just a drip has become a trickle, has become a small flow, and every now and then gets a little eddy in it that generates a new resource as people spontaneously create elements of a new language for living, a new design language. And I've begun harvesting that. So some of that harvest is in the garden farming pattern language. Zones of accumulation, for example, came out of an integration of my understanding of Holmgren's discussion of landscapes of erosion and deposition, which underlies the concept of the landscape catchment, pattern number one as well, but that there are always zones where resources are accumulating, and that it's our ability as humans, a particular gift, to find them, exploit them, develop them, and that permaculture designers needed to start to recognize that pattern at every scale that we worked, whether we were bringing in junk from the dump and piling it up. That's where the pattern was originally named. Oh, that pile of crap over there, that trash, that's your zone of accumulation. And when you organize it, it's a resource inventory. So those are patterns that my students helped me to recognize and which I captured and brought forward to my readers. And so it's gone. You know, some of the things grew directly out of our experience. I did the best I could in framing a garden farming system here on the edge of Bloomington, Indiana, where I live. And we've done certain things. They seem to me now elemental. I see people copying us. I think, oh, yeah, that was a pretty good guess. We needed a barn for storage and use and workshop, and we needed greenhouses, and we needed outdoor rooms, and we needed porches and trellises and awnings and water tanks and cisterns and so on and so on and so forth. So those all became like jewels in the watch movement of the garden farm. All of those patterns are like the jewels of a watch. They help organize the pieces that are in movement all the time, the energies that flow through the system. If we could name them, and they were familiar, and people understood these things from a cultural history and context, then they could begin to feel empowered to put this all together. They could begin to give a story to their visions that might have been inchoate previously. And that, I think, is beginning to happen.
And for me, it's a profound contribution to this next phase of permaculture. as we grow out of those original ideas from the 70s and 80s and into this next broader presentation of the material. I'm still stunned by it. It was one of those pieces of information that I had been looking for and looking for that brought a little bit more cohesion to the 12 principles as presented by Holmgren, you know, 16 to 18 by others, depending on how you choose to count them all up. But the way that you integrated all of that and how they're self-referential to build this pattern for someone who's working with maybe a backyard lot to a hobby farm of 4 or 5 acres, it just all made sense and was clear in ways that other presentations of this material wasn't. Well, as I said in my review, it's a piece that I'd love to have as its own separate booklet or pamphlet or something that could be printed off or included in someone's design kit so that we don't have to, as I know some people have done with Dave Jackie's series, the second book of Edible Forest Garden, some people bought an extra copy of that book just to rip the tables out of it to include in a binder to carry with them.
If you use it intensely enough, they fall out eventually.
Yeah, and the part of me that's a bookie and that used to be a bookseller, just it pains me to think about doing that to a book.
Well, your suggestion is appreciated, and it's not the first. People, including my editors, attempted in some way to first separate that from the book, and I felt, well, no, this is like taking the germ out of a seed. You can't do it. But, of course, now that we've successfully gotten the book out, I'm far more open to looking at whether that chapter might itself become another book or, you know, small booklet or pamphlet or collection. It could be gathered. Some of the drawings, and every one of those patterns has a drawing somewhere in the book, were used to help illustrate other chapters and pages. They might be recollected with the language itself, and perhaps there are even some thoughts. I've had a few. One of my cooperators, a fellow who's profiled in case study C in Graham, in Dawson, Ontario, suggested that a better formulation of the pattern fencing, I think it's 29 if I remember right, but is fencing gates. So I'm going to change it in the next edition or correction of the book, because in fact I do make that point, and the title could be more powerful by being more accurate. So there are probably some refinements, and I'm really eager to meet more people who've read and reflected on the language and begun to use it and find out where it's going to evolve, because languages, if they're real, are never static. They change and grow somewhat slowly, but they do. They acquire new usages, and that's one of the interesting things about speaking them. So this pattern language may have a fate of its own, and certainly it deserves to be widely known and used, and in that way, maybe a more accessible format so that people don't have to digest the whole of the handbook before being drawn in. It could be a good way to promote the book itself. People get excited about the pattern language, or so then maybe they'll turn to the rest of it. So you might get your wish.
If you do get around to that point, please put me on your mailing list. Let me know so that not only can I promote that, but also to buy my own copy to include in my gear. And I'll continue to do what I can to promote your primary book and all of that material in its form, because there is so much from it that was invaluable to me. Even though I've been kind of down this road for a number of years, there was plenty of aha moments for me reading it, especially as I mentioned in my review about the section on animals. There were things there that I haven't encountered before.
That was another deliberate part of the design of the book on my part, and I saw a gap and stepped into it there. Permaculture talks about animals all the time, and Andrew Jeeves' drawings of pigs and elephants and other things are throughout the Mollison's writings, but is it actually coherent for people? It always seemed a weak point in the presentation of permaculture, mostly because people don't have, unless they've grown up on the farm, much direct experience with livestock. So this is a first attempt to really, sort of clean up that section of the curriculum and give people a rational approach to the subject. You know, it's one, people typically either have 8-year-old feelings about animals, like, oh, you know, look at Fluffy, or they have disdain that comes out of turn away from animal agriculture, which has been horrific, you know, like, ah, I'm going to become a vegan. You know, I can't be part of this. Or so there's all. It's just cluttered with attitudes that aren't useful. It's like, look, these are translators. You can get less attached to plants and admire them and think, oh well, this is this and that does that. And we need, animals are much the same. Yes, they do have souls. I think yes, they're sentient creatures. Yes, they have emotions. Yes, they're red blooded. We can relate to them more closely, but they still are translators. They're ecological agents. They belong in our systems in a rational as well as in an emotional way. Anyway, my distraction here. I'm getting you off your track.
Quite all right. As you said that, there were certain things in my mindset because I was very used to that cellophane-wrapped anonymity of my meat because of the grocery store culture. And it was only as I transitioned to becoming a hunter to pay homage in a way to some of my heritage and some of the culture of where I live now, that I began to appreciate that relationship between people and animals in nature. Though really the first step of that transition was one night when my wife came home with a whole chicken, slapped it on a counter next to a copy of The Joy of Cooking, handed me my French chef's knife and said, here you go, break it apart. And I'm just looking at her with all... this cold chicken and a large sharp knife and a book, and she's just staring at me, hands on her hip, tapping her foot, and she's like, you want to learn how to do this? Now's the time.
You got a fiery one, didn't you?
I'm thankful for my wife because she's my cheerleader and one of the reasons why I continue to do this. And why I'm also afforded the time and opportunity to do it, because she feels that it's important that my children had a parent at home full time and that I was the person to do that. And as they transition into school, that I'm the one who's able to pursue this point of interest, being able to pursue this career, if you will, of permaculture and environmental education, because she keeps looking at me going, you know, you have until the first of our children gets to middle school to make this happen, because I'm quitting what I'm doing to do what I love. So find a way to do what you love now. So
that's very realistic. She sounds like a practical gal, and you're lucky to have her.
Yeah, it's a very nice experience. And whether it's a life partner in a spouse, a wife, a husband, or whatever kind of relationship someone has, or whether it's a friend sitting there ready to put a foot on your bum and get you going, I think it's important that everyone finds someone like that and finds that fire if they're not that type A who has it inside of them. So, but from that digression, I do want to get to what you're going to be doing over the next couple of weeks and months to be promoting your material.
Right. Well, let's see. December 4th is next Tuesday, and I will be addressing a class at Indiana University that day, which is a kind of local trial run on what I proposed to be doing over the following 2 weeks. Part of being an author isn't just writing, but it's actually sort of shepherding the book into the world. And whether you like that or not, and some part of me doesn't really want to be a promoter, but I have found it necessary to move my ideas into the world, to do more than simply write them down. You have to tell stories to people, and you have to go up and shake their hand, and you have to give them some idea that you're flesh and blood and not too different from them, and that they could maybe adopt some of these ideas. They wouldn't be terribly threatening. So that's part of the underlying work that I'm doing right now. The book came out June 1st, and a lot of people were anticipating it, and we moved a lot of copies on early sales and pre-orders, and then it's being picked up by people doing classes, and that's good. But now it needs to reach a wider audience. So I was fortunate early on, people who got the book saw it and were excited about it, and in the permaculture community invited me separately to come to New York and to come to Philadelphia. So that's been sitting in the back of my mind. I've been too busy over the summer just recovering and doing extra teaching and so on, and we had other matters going on here in the fall. So, and then the election kind of sucked all the oxygen out of everybody's attention for a long while. But after the dust settled, I got on the horn and sent out email messages to people and had begun conceiving of a book tour out east to the Northeast. It's possible just from here to put together sort of short hop trips between useful points where there's already some permaculture interest, where I have colleagues and friends, where there may be places I could stay. I'm launching out on the 7th of December, which is a Friday, from here. The first with a talk I'll be giving in Columbus, Ohio, on the OSU campus, Ohio State campus, on the book and the need for a regenerative agriculture and a local food security movement, if you will, a local food security revolution based in permaculture. So I'll be doing that talk and promoting the book along the way. I'm going from Columbus on the 7th. 10 cities in 10 days is the plan. I'm up to Cleveland the following day on the 8th, then to Dundas, Ontario, which is near Hamilton, then down to Ithaca, New York on the 10th, then Albany on the 11th, up to Montpelier, Vermont, possibly a little some other venues in Vermont on the 12th, then Amherst, Massachusetts on the 13th, then Brooklyn, New York on the 14th, then Philadelphia on the 15th, and I believe Central Virginia, probably Harrisonburg, on the 16th, and then back to Indiana. I can hope to hold up well enough to do that. Hope my voice doesn't give out and that we can attract a bunch of people along the way to show, turn out and share the enthusiasm for this body of work, get the book into more hands. So that's my plan, and along the way I may do one or more radio interviews and perhaps a few other side talks and meet with various people, my colleagues, and perhaps people in university programs that have an interest in permaculture and friends and students, and we'll just see what happens. That's the near term.
Certainly going to be a whirlwind tour. I do not envy you that kind of a trip. When I looked at the time that you'll be spending in Philadelphia, it's quite a few hours. You have a lot of work ahead of you in those days.
Yes, Philadelphia gets quite a few hours. That's true. We're going to do a workshop at the Aubrey Arboretum in the afternoon on Saturday the 15th on urban permaculture. And that's being sponsored by the Philadelphia Orchard Project. And I'll be co-teaching with Phil Forsyth, who was one of my students many years ago and has now been doing some excellent work there on the ground. I then give a talk in Philadelphia on the 15th at the Ethical Humanist Society down in Rittenhouse Square in the evening at 7:30. So that'll be a free public talk and book signing. And it's different in every city. There's places where we go to bookstores and there's places where we're, you know, in churches and all that kind of thing.
Well, the next time you bring out a book and you do another tour like this, if you come through the Northeast, I'll need to see if I can get you to stop in Harrisburg. We've got a beautiful little bookstore that's perfect for a talk.
I'm discovering I've managed to overlook a good half dozen or more potential venues. You know, it's like, maybe this will work, and maybe these people could help me do this. And then you find, like, offers of help and organizing are just, like, coming in, embarrassments of them. I could have gone as far as Portland, Maine, and somebody else wanted this in Burlington, Vermont, and, you know, maybe we'll still do some of that. I don't know, but, you know, you do your best. In any case, I'm grateful for all the help I've received and will receive, and have cast my bottle out on the waves.
Well, and I speak for myself, and I'm sure many others, that we're thankful that you took the time and energy to produce this book and are out there presenting this, because you are an articulate and eloquent presenter of this material, both as an author and as a speaker, which was delightful for me in this conversation that we've had. And I look forward to helping you along this way in every way that I can to spread this good word. But before I keep you for much longer or carry our conversation on too far, I do have two questions from listeners. If you have a few minutes that you could address those.
Oh, sure. Let's try it.
The first comes from your former student and my instructor, Ben Wise, and he was wondering, how large should Zone 5 be? as in how much wilderness do we need on the earth to support sustainable civilization?
All right, let's answer the easy parts of that, because it's a huge question, one that most people don't have any frame of reference for. There are roughly, of the earth's surface, about a quarter is land mass. So we could say immediately that the oceans are all a wilderness, very real and very much outside much human control. We do impact them dramatically and will continue to do so, but we should moderate our influences there so as to help return the oceans to health. This is a critical global issue. In particular, the areas of the ocean which are along the continental edges, which are the richest parts of the ocean, where nutrients from land are flushed into the sea and the water depth is limited, and so there's a lot more biological life and production. That's a lot of wilderness, but more maybe to your inquirer's point, to Ben's question, is what about the land? There are something like 38 billion acres of land surface on all the continents, and some of them are inaccessible. Essentially, we won't be doing much in Antarctica, even though the Antarctic Peninsula has in the last few years begun to grow trees again because it's losing ice cover and it's warming. We don't expect to do a lot more in the highly arid zones of the deserts of Africa and Asia and the Americas or Australia. So our impact is limited in those areas. We need, and this is based on estimates that I have from my own teacher in permaculture, Max Lindegger, humans need about 2 acres per person in the aggregate to provide environmental services and yields to support human life. Now, people can argue about that figure, and it's perhaps not in stone. It may vary from dry to wet environments. It almost certainly must. But if we take that as an average and let that be a measure of support that we need, then we should see human beings as cultivating, managing, or in some ways significantly impacting 14 billion acres of the Earth's 38 billion. That sounds like a modest proportion. Maybe it's a little less than 40%. And in fact, we do take about 40% of the Earth's net photosynthetic product today. I doubt that we can take much less than that, especially as we shift our economic basis, our energy basis, away from fossil fuels and onto solar-derived organic materials and energies. So I don't see our footprint shrinking in that way. Mollison has kind of held it out that we only need 4% of the land's surface area to grow our food, and that might be true, but we're still going to have to manage watersheds and range animals and harvest timber and do many things for our economy that involve the broad scale landscape. So my guess is zone 5 can be, that is where we do no management or only go to learn or to recoup genetic losses or what have you, could be as much as 60% of the land area, but it will be much more selectively that. We'll start by filling that 60% with all of the essentially unusable parts of the Earth's surface. And then we'll have a scrim of wildlands around our settlements that will be important. And some of those may be watershed areas where we might routinely harvest wild foods, but not make other impacts. I'm not sure that's helpful necessarily, but perhaps that's anyway how I would go about solving the problem or answering the question, as I would work from the large picture down to the small. We might need 40% of the Earth's surface, and we might need the best 40% of it to draw our economic sustenance from.
My quick back of the envelope math, which I don't guarantee is correct, leaves that to be about 22.8 billion acres then of wilderness at Zone 5.
Something like that, yes. But again, as I say, you know, Antarctica is 5 million square miles or 3 billion acres for 3.5 billion acres, you know, so that's part of that 22.
Okay.
And the Sahara Desert is nearly as large or, you know, two-thirds that size, so we quickly chunk up, and then there's the Canadian Arctic and much of Greenland and far large parts of Siberia. And so you see that when we come down to applying this in eastern North America, it may be that we can't significantly increase wilderness in this heavily populated region, but we might selectively protect and expand bits of it. I think the restoration strategy for Zone 5, one I've advocated and others before me, is that we link up the fragments of wilderness that exist with corridors and create around all of that sort of network or net of ecological reserves, buffer zones, which are lightly used, human-managed, but essentially compatible as edge zones around wilderness areas. We might think of them almost as Zone 4 or even of Zone 5, connected to cultivated systems. So, what does that mean? We'll see.
I'm just thinking of a conversation that I had with some previous guests about riparian corridors and other things, and how many acres of wilderness that could build if we used our streams and rivers as those corridors with a 100-foot buffer on either side.
Mm-hmm.
That quickly becomes acres and acres and acres of land for every mile.
Yes, yes. I think that's the approach. That rather than block out large pieces of wilderness and hold them separate from people, that we need it in all of our inhabited areas, and we need it on almost every property. I mean, I say that in the book. Even if you live in a little tiny urban lot, you need a wild spot in the corner, back by the fence, under the tree, where you have a little pond or a pile of rocks for the snakes to live in. You know, that's your Zone 5 there. But then beyond that, perhaps the rail line moving through the city or the bike trail or the stream bank and its edges through the park, and all of these areas become part of the lace of green architecture that holds the city in a relationship to its larger watershed and ecosystems.
And in that process, we also reintegrate those individuals with nature where they can see what a difference that makes and the impacts that they have on those environments.
Yes, and practically we provide habitat for many creatures that need to move across our arbitrary urban boundaries and highways and separating infrastructure and so forth. So we've got to work at keeping the green infrastructure, if you will, vital and expanding it.
Then our final question for this interview comes from Brent Verrill, who posted this on the Facebook page for the show. And this is a rather long question. I'm just going to go ahead and read the whole thing and we can take it from there. Would Mr. Bain please discuss the evolution of the problematic third ethic? My theory is that in all its incarnations, it has never been formulated as an ethical statement, and that has been the cause of all the contention. Just because it rhymes and because it can be considered an ethical statement from a particular point of view, fair share has problems because it sounds an awful lot like socialism to many people, and that isn't an ethic that many Americans, especially, are willing to support. Return of surplus isn't quite there because it tells us what to do. An ethical statement ought to be a frame through which we can view our choices, not a commandment. I like future care as a third ethic because I think it meets the standard for an ethical statement and because it works with the sing-songy formula, earth care, people care, future care.
This is a big bundle of questions. The first thing I want to say is that I don't agree that the third ethic has not been stated as an ethical injunction. I think that it has, and that your questioner has simply chosen to ignore or perhaps is unaware of how that's been done. If earth care or care of the earth and species is an ethical injunction, then certainly distribution of surplus and recognition of limits are ethical injunctions. Live within limits. So sometimes I have said of the third ethic that It has, in fact, I've expanded it to say that it is both fair share or distribution of that which is surplus to our own needs, to others, and to ecosystems. It is not practically separated from Brandt's suggestion of future care. We are, in fact, investing those surpluses into building natural and social capital, into the well-being of others, including non-human others, but also limits aware, which is another rhyming bit of this doggerel. We must be aware to set and respect limits, not only to natural systems. You can only hunt the deer in the fall at certain times. Those are limits to natural systems that we recognize, but aware of our ecological impacts and the limits that we are already transgressing, exceeding, stepping across, living as we do. And Americans are particularly in need of this awareness. So it's pointed that Brandt brings in Americans' distaste for the word socialism. I would disagree with him that Americans, most Americans or many Americans, wouldn't have much to do with socialism. I would say, from the other perspective, from my perspective, many Americans embrace it. They just don't use the word. The entire American military is a socialist organization, for all that it's used to enforce the demands of empire. You know, it's basically you do what you're told to do and we provide for you. And there's an awful lot of people who live in various forms of socialist institutions. And we pay lip service to free enterprise, but we actually subsidize the richest, most powerful corporations in the country, massively the banks. This is socialism. This is socialism for the rich. We have lots of socialism in this country. It's an idiotic system that most people don't like. They just don't recognize that it's socialism. Socialism was supposed to be about distributing the wealth of society or the surpluses of society for the benefit of everyone. And we don't do particularly a good job of that. We do some things, though. We do, in fact, provide for ourselves collectively by offering old age assistance and taking care of the roads and all of these other kinds of things. And we tax people differentially, from each according to his means or abilities to each according to his or her needs. Well, it's not straight line, but there's an awful lot of that. So I kind of think that socialism is a bit of a red herring in this question here, and I think that we ought to separate it out from what fair share means. Nature distributes surpluses. Nature is full of surpluses, and it distributes them. When the spring energies hit in North America, there's an explosion of insect life, and nature sends in vast whole flocks of birds that migrate north across the Caribbean from South and Central America to come and eat them. That then go on the wing and spread that bird poop all over the continent. This is nature's distribution of surplus. And you could find it in every existing natural system. We've diminished those surpluses a great deal because we saw them and we said, oh, box for us, let's take it all. That's what we did with the passenger pigeon. We exterminated the passenger pigeon because we thought, well, they're endless. The surplus will never end. There's just more of it. Let's organize to take it all, or take as much as we can. We couldn't possibly put an end to this, but we did. So that's entirely unethical behavior. It came about rather unconsciously, without an awareness of the limits, and that's the important part that supports fair share. You have to know what the limits are. Then you have to act on that knowledge by restraining your own behavior from consuming that which you don't need and distributing that surplus. You don't have one unless you know what your needs are, to the benefit of other systems. Now, those systems can benefit you. In fact, they do. So it's kind of an extended altruistic, if you will, selfishness. By taking care of our larger selves, our families, our neighborhoods, our communities, the ecosystems around us, we take care of ourselves, of our personal needs. We ensure that they'll be met over the long cycle. And this is where future care is very relevant. I don't object to that at all. In fact, I tell my students, every one of them, and my readers as well, Here's your job assignment going forward. Plant forests, build soil, store water, and save seed and all other forms of genetic diversity. Do those four things because you have to build and cultivate and live for the future. We've lived off of the surpluses of the past too long. We've overdrawn our account. We have to rebuild capital now, natural and social. We have to give more than we take. It's not a matter of stopping taking. We have to take in order to eat, to live, to reproduce. But we've got to stop taking as much in relation to what we give back. So that's the essence of the third ethic, is giving back. It's not about merely caring and nurturing. It's about deliberately recognizing and using the surpluses of nature for the benefit of the whole. And that's a very powerful ethical injunction, one that Americans are particularly susceptible to not understanding, because we have so much privilege. We have taken so much from all over the world for so many decades, my entire life and beyond, this whole imperial period, at least since the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries and the Spanish-American War and the overt expression of empire. We've taken and taken and taken, and we've created a whole ideology of exceptionalism. We're better, morally superior. It used to be very racist. Now it's much more subtle. We're better. We're more noble and idealistic than other people. We have the grace of God cheering us on. We're entitled to this. It's just an expanded justification for vast selfishness. And the powers of our society have used that mythology to enlist popular support for all of our imperial misadventures. Short circuit, not trying to drive this into a Sunday homily here, but we have to recognize what we've done, how we've lived, the impact on the world. We consume, for God's sakes, 25% of the world's resources. We're 5% of the people. That is patently unfair. Now, I don't like the idea of giving up my comforts any more than anyone else. But if we do not confront that and face that, then we are empty, morally bankrupt. No one should listen to us. And that's the essence of the third ethic. It's got a bite to it. And that's why people sidle up to it with some discomfort. It's like, ooh, I don't know, maybe it's wrong. Maybe I didn't write it right. Maybe I don't know about that. And in fact, it wants to bite you in the butt because your butt's a little too big.
It's not that the ethic itself was written poorly, but from our cultural lens, we decide to choose our personal scripture of how to read into it to make it more palatable without being aware of the need for limits and the impact that we have as privileged Americans.
That's the way I put it together, Scott. That's my opinion in any case. Maybe you agree and maybe you don't, but others will have their view. As one who's worked with it, that's how I see it.
Well, and I appreciate that answer. It's something I'm definitely going to have to rewind and look forward to listening to again because of the breadth that you took with that answer. And the idea of privilege is one that I grew up white, middle class, educated, and privilege is something that only recently has become an issue. Well, not really an issue, but a topic that I've begun to understand because of everything that American society has provided for me over the years. I don't know what it's like to be marginalized in any way because of things that I don't have a choice over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the historical context of slavery and racism in America. Never understood that. Yet I grew up in an area where the population was 99.7% white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant. The Catholics in my community were marginalized. The Jewish population was very small. But for me, my first girlfriend was African American, and nobody in my family thought that that was strange or different. I grew up with a family where it was, as you were talking about earlier, about that sense of collection and community and caring for one another. I had cousins who I wasn't related to, but that was normal. We didn't care who someone's parent was, whether they were from a previous marriage or post-divorce. They were still part of the family. And because of that kind of insular community, that awareness wasn't there for me that other people didn't live like that. that there were these issues of violence and sexual discrimination, racial discrimination, and all these other things. So I can understand how getting a grip on privilege as an American can be something difficult if you've never been exposed to it, and how that plays out with permaculture and ethics and caring for others. And as you said earlier, and Chuck Marsh points out, that need for Americans isn't there because of that privilege that we've had. And that, as you say, 25% of the resources in the world are consumed by 5% of the population. And there was something in one of my sociology classes I was pointed to, and it was a calculator where you could put in what your income was. And it puts you then at what your percentage is in the world population. And as you understand that worldwide, if we were to evenly distribute the gross domestic product of the world, worldwide, everyone would earn about $9,000. Yet in America, $9,000 is very deeply into poverty, that people who are making twice that are very privileged compared to the rest of the world. But those are conversations that we'll have to continue to have moving forward as Americans, and get that to enter into our consciousness. But rather than take that any further, thank you so much for everything that you brought, your answer to the third ethic, the things that it's made me think about. And I thank Brent for that question.
It's very provocative and worthwhile, so it's good. I'm glad he raised it, and I'm glad you passed it along and we were able to talk about it. I think it goes to the heart of much of what we are trying to do here in all of this.
And I've had you for quite some time, longer than I originally asked you for when scheduling this. Before I keep you any longer, is there anything else that you'd like to add to this discussion or conversation for the listeners?
Well, any of you who are within reach of my proposed December book tour, I invite you to turn out where it might be convenient. We'll be in the cities I named, and there's information about the tour available at permaculturehandbook.com. That's also the address for learning more about the book or ordering the book. I really encourage you. There are a lot of ways to buy it, but if you buy it from us, then the author actually benefits in a significant way. And so I would encourage your readers to consider that. And thank you very much for your thoughtful questions and this interesting dialogue, and for what you're doing as a podcaster. I hope it continues to grow and flourish.
Thank you very much for this time that you've spent with us. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
All right, Scott. Take care.
And that was Peter Bain. After having this conversation with him and listening to it again and hearing some of the depth and breadth of his answers, I can see why my instructor, Ben, thinks so highly of him. If you have an opportunity to go see Peter, I highly recommend it, and I'm hoping to make it to his Philadelphia tour that's coming up shortly. If you're listening and anywhere within commuting distance of any of his upcoming locations in the Northeast United States or Ontario, Canada, I recommend going and giving a listen or joining one of the workshops along the way if you have the opportunity. To help you along that path, here are the details of where he's going to be between Friday, December 17th and Sunday, December 16th, 2012. On his book tour. Beginning on Friday, December 7th, he'll be in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State University from 7 to 9 p.m., giving a free lecture. On December 8th, he'll be in Cleveland, Ohio, giving a permaculture seminar from 1 to 3 p.m. But as I record this, the location hasn't been determined yet, though I do have contact information in the show notes and on the website for who you can call to find out more. And all the information that I have for each of these is in the show notes or on the website or, as Peter said, at thepermaculturehandbook.com. Sunday, December 9th, he'll be in Dundas, Ontario at Old 99 Farm for a permaculture workshop from 1 to 5 p.m. Monday, December 10th, he'll be in Ithaca, New York at the Cornell Cooperative Extension from 7 to 9 p.m. for a free lecture. Tuesday, December 11th, sees Peter in Albany, New York at the Unitarian Universalist Association for a free lecture from 7 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, December 12th, in Montpelier, Vermont at the Unitarian Universalist Association is a lecture from 7 to 9 p.m. They are requesting a small donation. Thursday, December 13th, is two stops, one in Brattleboro, Vermont, the Brattleboro Food Co-op, for an author reading and book signing from 1:30 to 3 p.m., and they're asking that you bring a lunch. That evening, from 7 to 9 p.m., in Amherst, Massachusetts, is a free talk at the Food for Thought Books. December 14th, I'll be in Brooklyn, New York, at the Commons, Brooklyn, for a free lecture from 7 to 9 p.m. Next is Philadelphia, on December 15th, with a first stop at the Aubrey Arboretum for an urban permaculture workshop from 1 till 4 p.m., which will be co-taught with Phil Forsyth of the Philadelphia Orchard Project. And then in the evening from 7:30 to 9 p.m. will be a free lecture at the Ethical Humanist Society. Wrapping up all of this, Peter will be in Harrisonburg, Virginia on December 16th at the Clementine Cafe Lounge for a free talk from 7 to 9 p.m. If you haven't read his book and would like to pick up a copy of it, they will be available at all locations for $45. And if anyone is going to make it to the Aubrey Arboretum event on December 15th, I'm hoping to make it there. I'm still working everything out here on my end. But if you can cross your fingers for me, I'd really appreciate it. That covers our time with Peter Bain for now. And as we begin to wrap up 2012, entering into this last month, if you can give the show a hand, please do. Stop by thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and find out how. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.